Side 6, The Diamond Throne, by David Eddings. Continuing on page 244. Xavier was young and somewhat slender. His complexion was olive and his hair curly and blue-black. With some show of ceremony, Naschen descended the steps of the chapter house with Sparhawk and Colton to greet him. "Our house is honored, Sir Xavier," he said. Xavier inclined his head stiffly. "My lord," he responded. "I am commanded by the preceptor of my order to convey to you his greetings." "Thank you, Sir Xavier," Naschen said, somewhat taken aback by the young knight's stiff formality. "Sir Sparhawk," Xavier said then, again inclining his head. "Do we know each other, Xavier?" "Our preceptor described you to me, my lord Sparhawk, you and your companion, Sir Colton. Have the others arrived yet?" Sparhawk shook his head. "No, you're the first." "Come inside, Sir Xavier," Naschen said then. "We'll assign you a cell so that you can get out of your armor, and I'll speak to the kitchen about a hot meal. And it please you, my lord, might I first visit your chapel? I have been some days on the road, and I feel sorely the need for prayer in a consecrated place." "Of course," Naschen said to him. "We'll see to your horse," Sparhawk told the young man. "Thank you, Lord Sparhawk." Xavier bent his head again and followed Naschen up the steps. "Oh, he's going to be a jolly traveling companion," Colton said ironically. "He'll loosen up once he gets to know us," Sparhawk said. "I hope you're right. I'd heard that the Cyrenics are a shade formal, but I think our young friend there might be carrying it to extremes." Curiously, he unhooked the lochaber from the saddle bow. "Can you imagine using this thing on somebody?" He shuddered. The lochaber axe had a heavy 2-foot blade surmounted at its forward end with a razor-sharp hawk-like bill. Its heavy handle was about 4 feet long. You could shuck a man out of his armor like an oyster out of its shell with this. "I think that's the idea. It is sort of intimidating, isn't it?" "Put it away, Colton. Don't play with another man's toys." After Sir Xavier had completed his prayers and changed out of his armor, he joined them in Naschen's ornate study. "Did they give you something to eat?" Naschen asked. "It isn't necessary, my lord," Xavier replied. "If I may be permitted, I'll join you and your knights in refectory for the noon meal." "Of course," Naschen replied. "You're more than welcome to join us, Xavier." Sparhawk then introduced Xavier to Sophronia. The young man bowed deeply to her. "I have heard much of you, lady," he said. "Our instructors in the Styrix secrets hold you in great esteem."
"You're kind to say so, Sir Knight. My skills are the result of age and practice, however, and do not result from any particular virtue."
"Age, lady? Surely not! You can scarce be much older than I, and I will not see my 30th year for some months yet. The bloom of youth has not yet left your cheeks, and your eyes quite overwhelm me."
Sophronia smiled warmly at him, then looked critically at Colton and Sparhawk. "I hope you two are paying attention," she said. "A little polish wouldn't hurt either of you."
"I was never much good at formality, little mother," Colton confessed.
"I've noticed," she said.
"Flute,"
she said a bit wearily then, "please put the book down. I've asked you again and again not to touch one."
Several days later, Sir Tinian and Sir Euleth arrived, riding together. Tinian was a good-humored Alcyone knight from Deira, the kingdom lying to the north of Elenia. His broad, round face was open and friendly. His shoulders and chest were powerfully muscled as the result of years of bearing Deiran armor, the heaviest in the world. Over his massive armor he wore a sky-blue surcoat. Euleth was a hulking Genidian knight, fully a head taller than Sparhawk. He did not wear armor, but rather a plain mail shirt and a simple conical helmet. Covering his shirt he wore a green surcoat. He carried a large, round shield and a heavy war axe. Euleth was a silent, withdrawn man who seldom spoke. His blonde hair hung in 2 braids down his back.
"Good morning, gentlemen," Tinian said to Sparhawk and Colton as he dismounted in the courtyard of the chapter house. He looked at them closely. "You would be Sir Sparhawk," he said. "Our preceptor said that you'd broken your nose sometime." He grinned then. "It's all right, Sparhawk. It doesn't interfere with your kind of beauty."
"I'm going to like this man," Colton said.
"And you must be Colton," Tinian said. He thrust out his hand and Colton took it before he realized that the Alcyone was holding a dead mouse concealed in his palm.
With a startled oath, he jerked his hand back. Tinian howled with laughter.
"I think I could get to like him as well," Sparhawk noted.
"My name is Tinian," the Alcyone knight introduced himself. "My silent friend there is Yuleth from Thalesia. He caught up with me a few days ago. Hasn't spoken 10 words since then."
"You talk enough for both of us," Yuleth grunted, sliding out of his saddle.
"That's God's own truth," Tinian admitted. "I have this overwhelming fondness for the sound of my own voice." Yuleth thrust out his huge hand.
"Sparhawk," he said.
"No mice?" Sparhawk asked. A faint smile touched Yuleth's face as they clasped hands. Then he shook hands with Colton, and the four of them went up the steps into the chapter house.
"Has Bavier arrived yet?" Tinian asked Colton.
"A few days back. Have you ever met him?"
"Once.
Our preceptor and I made a formal visit to Larium, and we were introduced to the Cyrenics in their mother house there. I found him to be a bit stiff-necked and formal.
That hasn't changed much."
"Didn't think it had.
Exactly what are we going to do down in Camoria? Preceptor Darylon can be infuriatingly close-mouthed on occasion."
"Let's wait until Bavier joins us," Sparhawk suggested.
"I get the feeling that he might be a little touchy, so let's not offend him by talking business out of his presence."
"Good thinking, Sparhawk. This show of unity could fall apart on us if Bavier starts sulking. I'll have to admit that he can be a good man in a fight, though. Is he still carrying that Lochaber?"
"Oh, yes," Colton said.
"Gruesome thing, isn't it? I saw him practicing with it at Larium. He cut the top off a post as thick as my leg with one swipe at a full gallop. I get the feeling that he could ride through a platoon of foot troops and leave a trail of loose heads behind him 10 yards wide."
"Let's hope it doesn't come to that," Sparhawk said.
"If that's your attitude, Sparhawk, you're going to take all the fun out of this excursion."
"I am going to like him," Colton said.
Sir Bavier joined them in Nashon's study after the completion of noon services in the chapel. As closely as Sparhawk could determine, Bavier had not missed services once since his arrival.
"All right, then," Sparhawk said, rising to his feet when they were all assembled. "This is sort of where we stand. Annius, the primate of Cimera, has his eyes on the archprelate's throne here in Kyrelos. He controls the Alanian Royal Council, and they're giving him money out of the royal treasury. He's trying to use that money to buy enough votes in the hierocracy to win election after Clavonus dies. The preceptors of the four orders want to block him."
"No decent churchman would accept money for his vote," Bavier said, his voice verging on outrage.
"I'll grant that," Sparhawk agreed. "Unfortunately, many churchmen are far from decent. Let's be honest about it, gentlemen. There's a wide streak of corruption in the Aline Church. We might wish it were different, but we have to face the facts. Many of those votes are for sale. Now, and this is important, Queen Alana is unwell, otherwise she wouldn't allow Annius to have access to the treasury. The preceptors agree that the best way to stop Annius is to find some way to cure the queen and put her back in power. That's why we're going to Baratha. There are physicians at the university there who might be able to determine the nature of her illness and find a cure for it."
"Are we taking your queen with us?" Tinian asked.
"No, that's quite impossible."
"It's going to be a little hard for the physicians to find out much then, isn't it?"
Sparhawk shook his head.
"Sifrenia, the Pandion instructor in the secrets, will be going with us. She can describe Queen Alana's symptoms in great detail, and she can raise an image of the queen if the physicians need a closer look."
"Seems a bit roundabout," Tinian noted.
"But if that's the way we have to do it, then that's the way we'll do it."
"There's a great deal of unrest in Camoria right now," Sparhawk went on. "The central kingdoms are all infested with Zamok agents, and they're trying to stir up as much trouble as they can. Not only that, Annius is fairly certain to guess at what we're trying to do, so he'll try to interfere."
"Barata's a long way from Cimera, isn't it?" Tinian asked. "Does Primate Annius have so long an arm?"
"Yes," Sparhawk said. "He does. There's a renegade Pandion in Camoria who sometimes works for Annius. His name is Martell, and he's likely to try to stop us."
"Only once," Yuleth grunted.
"Let's not go out of our way looking for a fight, though," Sparhawk cautioned. "Our main task is to get Sifrenia safely to Baratha and back. There's been at least one attempt on her life already." We'll want to discourage that, Tinian said. Are we taking anybody else with us?
My squire, Curic, Sparhawk replied, and probably a young Pandion novice named Bayret. He shows some promise, and Curic's going to need somebody along to help him care for the horses.
He thought a moment.
I think we'll take a boy along as well, he said.
Talon?
Calton sounded surprised at that.
Is that really a good idea, Sparhawk?
Kyralos is corrupt enough already. I don't think it's a good idea to turn that little thief loose in the streets. Besides, I think we may find uses for his specialized talents. The only other person going with us will be a little girl named Flute.
Calton stared at him in astonishment.
Sophrenia won't leave her behind, Sparhawk explained. And I'm not sure she can be left behind. You remember how easily she got out of that nunnery in Arsham.
You've got a point there, I guess, Calton conceded.
A very straightforward presentation, Sir Sparhawk, Xavier said approvingly. When will we leave?
First thing in the morning, Sparhawk replied. It's a long way to Barata, and the archprelate isn't getting younger. Patriarch Dolmant says that he could die at any time, and that's when Aeneas will start to move.
We must make our preparations then, Xavier said, rising to his feet. Will you gentlemen be joining me in the chapel for evening services? He asked.
Calton sighed.
I suppose we should, he said. We are church knights, after all.
And a bit of God's help wouldn't hurt, would it? Tinian added.
Late that afternoon, however, a company of church soldiers arrived at the gates of the chapter house.
I have a summons from the Patriarch Makova for you and your companions, Sir Sparhawk,
the captain in charge of the soldiers said when Sparhawk and the others came down into the courtyard.
He would speak with you in the basilica at once.
We'll get our horses, Sparhawk said. He led the rest of the knights into the stables. Once inside, he swore irritably.
Trouble? Tinian asked him.
Makova's a supporter of Primate Aeneas, Sparhawk replied, leading Farron out of his stall. I've got a strong suspicion that he's going to try to hinder us.
We must respond to his summons, however, Xavier said, swinging his saddle up onto his horse's back. We are church knights and must obey the commands of a member of the hierocracy, no matter what his affiliation.
And there's that company of soldiers out there, too, Calton added. I'd say that Makova doesn't take too many chances.
Surely he doesn't think we'd refuse, Xavier said.
You don't know Sparhawk that well yet, Calton told him. He can be contrary at times.
Well, we don't have any choice in the matter, Sparhawk said. Let's go to the basilica and see what the Patriarch has to say to us.
They led their horses out into the courtyard and mounted. At a crisp command from the captain, the soldiers formed up around them. The square in front of the basilica was strangely deserted as Sparhawk and his friends dismounted.
Looks to me as if they're expecting trouble, Calton noted as they started up the broad marble stairs.
When they entered the vast nave of the church, Xavier went down on his knees and clasped his hands in front of him. The captain and a squad of his soldiers entered behind them.
We must not keep the Patriarch waiting, he said.
There was a certain arrogant tone in his voice that irritated Sparhawk for some reason. He muffled that feeling, however, and piously dropped to his knees beside Xavier. Calton grinned and also knelt. Tinian nudged Euleth, and they too went down on their knees.
I said,
the captain began, his voice rising slightly.
We heard you, neighbor, Sparhawk said to him. We'll be with you presently.
But
you can wait over there. We won't be too long.
The captain turned and stalked off.
Nice touch, Sparhawk, Tinian murmured.
We are church knights, after all, Sparhawk replied. It won't hurt Makova to wait a while. I'm sure he'll enjoy the anticipation.
I'm sure, Tinian agreed.
The five knights remained kneeling for perhaps 10 minutes while the captain stalked about impatiently.
Have you finished, Xavier? Sparhawk asked politely when the Cyrenic unclasped his hands.
Yes,
Xavier answered, his face alight with devotion. I feel cleansed now, and at peace with the world.
Try to hang on to that feeling. The Patriarch of Coom is likely to irritate us all.
Sparhawk rose to his feet.
Shall we go then?
Well, finally,
the captain snapped as they joined him and his men. Xavier looked at him coldly.
Have you any rank, Captain? He asked. Aside from your military one, I mean.
I am a Marquis, Sir Xavier.
Excellent. If our devotions offend you, I will be more than happy to give you satisfaction. You may have your seconds call upon me at any time. I will be at your complete disposal. The captain paled visibly and shrank back. I am merely following my orders, my lord. I would not dream of giving offense to a knight of the church.
Ah, Xavier said distantly. Let us proceed, then. As you stated so excellently earlier, we must not keep the Patriarch of Coombe waiting.
The captain led them to a hallway branching out from the nave.
Nicely done, Xavier, Tinian whispered.
The Cyrenic smiled briefly.
There's nothing like the offer of a yard or so of steel in his belly to remind a man of his manners, Carlton added.
The chamber to which the captain led them was grandiose, with deep maroon carpeting and drapes and polished marble walls. The lean-faced Patriarch of Coombe sat at a long table reading a parchment. He looked up as they were admitted, his face angry.
"What took so long?" he snapped at the captain.
"The knights of the church felt obliged to spend a few moments in devotions before the main altar, Your Grace."
"Oh, of course.
May I withdraw, Your Grace?"
"No. Stay. It shall fall to you to enforce the dictates I will issue here."
"As it please, Your Grace." Markova then looked sternly at the knights.
"I am told that you gentlemen are planning a foray into Camoria," he said.
"We haven't made any secret of it, Your Grace," Sparhawk replied.
"I forbid it."
"Might one ask why, Your Grace?" Tinian asked mildly.
"No, one may not. The church knights are subject to the authority of the hierocracy. Explanations are not required. You are all to return to the Pandion chapter house, and you will remain there until it pleases me to send you further instructions."
He smiled a chill smile.
"I believe you will all be returning home very shortly."
Then he drew himself up.
"That will be all. You have my permission to withdraw. Captain, you will see to it that these knights do not leave the Pandion chapter house."
"Yes, Your Grace."
They all bowed and silently filed out the door.
"That was short, wasn't it?"
Carlton said as they went back down the corridor with the captain some distance in the lead.
"There wasn't much point in fogging the issue with lame excuses," Sparhawk replied.
Carlton leaned toward his friend. "Are we going to obey his orders?" he whispered.
"No."
"Sir Sparhawk," Xavier gasped. "Surely you would not disregard the commands of a patriarch of the church."
"No, not really. All I need is a different set of orders."
"Dolmant?" Carlton guessed.
"His name does sort of leap to mind, doesn't it?"
They had, however, no opportunity for side trips. The officious captain insisted upon escorting them directly back to the chapter house.
"Sir Sparhawk," he said as they reached the narrow street where the house stood, "you will be so good as to advise the governor of your establishment that this gate is to remain closed. No one is to enter or leave."
"I'll tell him," Sparhawk replied.
Then he nudged Farron and rode on into the courtyard.
"I didn't think he'd actually seal the gate," Carlton muttered. "How are we going to get word to Dolmant?"
"I'll think of something," Sparhawk said.
Later, as twilight crept in over the city, Sparhawk paced along the parapet surmounting the wall of the chapter house, glancing from time to time down into the street outside.
"Sparhawk," Keurig's gruff voice came from the yard below. "Are you up there?"
"Yes, come on up."
There was the sound of footsteps on the stone stairs leading up to the parapet.
"You wanted to see us?" Keurig asked as he, Beirut, and Talon came up out of the shadows clotting the stairway.
"Yes. There's a company of church soldiers outside. They're blocking the gate, and I need to get a message to Dolmant. Any ideas?"
Keurig scratched his head as he mulled it over.
"Give me a fast horse and I can ride through them," Beirut offered.
"He'll make a good knight," Talon said. "Knights love to charge, I'm told."
Beirut looked sharply at the boy.
"No hitting," Talon said, shrinking back. "We agreed that there wasn't going to be any more hitting. I pay attention to the lessons, and you don't hit me anymore."
"Have you got a better idea?" Beirut asked.
"Several."
Talon looked over the wall. "Are the soldiers patrolling the streets outside the walls?" he asked.
"Yes," Sparhawk said.
"That's not really a problem, but it might have been easier if they weren't." Talon pursed his lips as he thought it over.
"Beirut," he said, "are you any good with a bow?"
"I've been trained," the novice said a bit stiffly.
"That's not what I asked. I said, are you any good?"
"I can hit a mark at 100 paces.
Talon looked at Sparhawk.
"Don't you people have anything better to do?" he asked.
Then he looked at Beirut again.
"You see that stable over there?"
he asked, pointing across the street.
"The one with the thatched roof?"
"Yes."
"Could you get an arrow into the thatch?"
"Easily."
"Maybe training pays off after all."
"How many months did you practice cutting purses?" Kurek asked pointedly.
"That's different, father. There's a profit involved in that."
"Father?" Beirut sounded astonished. "It's a long story," Kurek told him.
"Any man in the world listens to a bell that rings for any reason whatsoever," Talon said, affecting a schoolteacherish tone. "And no man can possibly avoid gawking at a fire. Can you lay your hands on a length of rope, Sparhawk?"
"How long a length?"
"Long enough to reach the street. Here's how it goes. Beirut wraps his arrow with tinder and sets fire to it. Then he takes a shot at the thatched roof. The soldiers will all run to this street to watch the fun. That's when I go down the rope on the far side of the building. I can be out on the street in less than a minute with no one the wiser."
"You can't set fire to a man's stable," Kurek objected, sounding horrified.
"They'll put it out, Kurek," Talon said in a patient tone. "They'll have lots of warning because we'll all stand up here shouting fire at the top of our lungs. Then I'll skin down the rope on the far wall and be 5 streets away before the excitement dies down. I know where Dolman's house is, and I can tell him whatever you want him to know."
"All right," Sparhawk approved.
"Sparhawk!" Kurek exclaimed. "You're not going to let him do this, are you?"
"It's tactically sound, Kurek. Diversion and subterfuge are part of any good plan."
"Do you have any idea of how much thatch and wood there is in this part of town?"
"It might give the church soldiers something useful to do," Sparhawk shrugged.
"That's hard, Sparhawk." "Not nearly as hard as the notion of Annius sitting on the archprelate's throne. Let's get what we need. I want to be out of Kyrillos before the sun comes up tomorrow, and I can't do that with all those soldiers camped outside the gate." They went down the stairs to fetch rope, a bow, and a quiver of arrows. "What's afoot?" Tinian asked, as he, Colton, Davier, and Euleth met them in the courtyard. "We're going to get word to Dolmant," Sparhawk told him. Tinian looked at the bow Beirut was carrying.
"With that?"
he asked. "Isn't that rather a long shot?" "There's a little more to it than that," Sparhawk told him. He quickly sketched in the plan. Then, as they started up the steps, he put his hand on Talon's shoulder. "This isn't going to be the safest thing in the world," he told the boy. "I want you to be careful out there."
"You worry too much, Sparhawk," Talon replied. "I could do this in my sleep."
"You might need some kind of note to give to Dolmant," Sparhawk said.
"You're not serious! If I get stopped, I can lie my way out of trouble, but not if I've got a note in my pocket. Dolmant knows me, and he'll know that the message is from you. Just leave everything to me, Sparhawk."
"Don't stop to pick any pockets along the way."
"Of course not," Talon replied, just a little too glibly.
Sparhawk sighed. Then he quickly told the boy what to say to the Patriarch of Deimos. The plan went more or less as Talon had outlined it. As soon as the patrol had passed in the narrow street, Beirut's arrow arched out like a falling star and sank into the thatched stable roof. It sputtered there for a moment or two, and then bluish-colored flame ran quickly up to the ridgepole, turning sooty orange first, then bright yellow as the flames began to spread.
"Fire!"
Talon yelled.
"Fire!"
the rest echoed. In the street below, the church soldiers came pounding around the corner to be met by the nearly hysterical owner of the stables.
"Good masters!" the poor man cried, wringing his hands. "My stable! My horses! My house! My God!"
The officious captain hesitated, looking first at the fire, then back at the looming wall of the chapter house in an agony of indecision.
"We'll help you, Captain," Tinian called down from the wall. "Open the gate."
"No,"
the captain shouted back.
"Stay inside."
"You could lose half of the holy city, you blockhead," Colton roared at him. "That fire will spread if you don't do something immediately."
"You,"
the captain snapped at the commoner who owned the stable.
"Fetch buckets and show me the nearest well."
He turned quickly to his men. "Form up a line," he commanded. "Go to the front gate of the Pandion House and bring back every man we can spare." He sounded decisive now. Then he squinted up at the knights on the parapet. "But leave a detachment on guard there," he ordered. "We can still help, Captain," Tinian offered. "There's a deep well here. We can turn out our men and pass buckets to your men outside the gate. Our major concern here must be the saving of Kyrillos. Everything else must be secondary to that." The captain hesitated. "Please, Captain," Tinian's voice throbbed with sincerity. "I beg of you, let us help." "Very well," the captain snapped. "Open your gate. But no one is to leave the chapter house grounds." "Of course not," Tinian replied.
"Nicely done," Euleth grunted, tapping Tinian on the shoulder with his fist.
Tinian grinned at him. "Talking does pay off now and then, my silent friend. You should try it sometime."
"I'd rather use an axe."
"Well, I guess I'll be leaving now, my lords," Talon said. "Was there anything you'd like to have me pick up for you, since I'll be out and about anyway?"
"Keep your mind on what you're supposed to do," Sparhawk told him. "Just go talk to Dolmant."
"And be careful," Curic growled. "You're a disappointing son sometimes, but I don't want to lose you."
"Sentimentality, father," Talon said, affecting surprise.
"Not really," Curic replied. "Just a certain sense of responsibility to your mother."
"I'll go with him," Barrett said.
Talon looked critically at the rangy novice.
"Forget it," he said shortly. "You'd just be in my way. Forgive me, revered teacher, but your feet are too big and your elbows stick out too far to move around quietly, and I don't have time to teach you how to sneak right now."
The boy disappeared into the shadows along the parapet.
"Where did you find that rare youth?" Xavier asked.
"You wouldn't believe it, Xavier," Colton replied. "You absolutely wouldn't believe it.
Our Pandion brothers are perhaps a bit more worldly than the rest of us, Xavier," Tinian said sententiously. "We who fix our eyes firmly on heaven are not so versed in the seamier side of life as they are." He looked piously at Colton. "We all serve, however, and I'm sure that God appreciates your efforts, no matter how dishonest or depraved."
"Well put," Euleth said with an absolutely straight face.
The fire in the thatched roof continued to smoke and steam as the church soldiers threw bucket after bucket of water onto it during the next quarter hour. Gradually, by sheer dint of numbers and the volume of water poured on it, the fire was quenched, leaving the owner of the stable bemoaning the saturation of his store of fodder, but preventing any spread of the flames.
"Bravo, Captain, bravo!" Tinian cheered from atop the wall.
"Don't overdo it," Euleth muttered to him.
"It's the first time I've ever seen any of those fellows do anything useful," Tinian protested. "That sort of thing ought to be encouraged."
"We could set some more fires if you'd like," the huge Genidian offered. "We could keep them hauling water all week."
Tinian tugged at one earlobe.
"No," he said after a moment's thought. "They might get bored with the novelty and decide to let the city burn."
He glanced at Curic.
"Did the boy get away?" he asked.
"As slick as a snake going down a rat hole," Sparhawk's squire replied, trying to conceal the note of pride in his voice.
"Someday you'll have to tell us about why the lad keeps calling you father."
"We might get to that one day, my lord Tinian," Curic muttered.
As the first light of dawn crept up the eastern sky, there came the measured tread of hundreds of feet some distance up the narrow street outside the front gate of the chapter house. Then the Patriarch Dolmant, astride a white mule, came into view at the head of a battalion or more of red-liveried soldiers.
"Your Grace,"
the soot-smeared captain who had been blocking the gate of the chapter house exclaimed, rushing forward with a salute.
"You are relieved, Captain," Dolmant told him. "You may return with your men to your barracks."
He sniffed a bit disapprovingly.
"Tell them to clean up," he suggested. "They look like chimney sweeps."
"Your Grace,"
the captain faltered. "I was commanded by the Patriarch of Coombe to secure this house. May I send to him for confirmation of your Grace's counter-order?" Dolmant considered it.
"No, Captain," he said. "I don't think so. Retire at once."
"But your Grace!"
Dolmant slapped his hands sharply together, and the troops massed at his back moved into position, their pikes advanced.
Colonel, Dolmant said in the mildest of tones to the commander of his troops. Would you be so good as to escort the captain and his men back to their barracks?
At once, Your Grace, the officer replied with a sharp salute.
And I think they should be confined there until they are presentable.
Of course, Your Grace, the colonel said soberly. I myself shall conduct the inspection.
Meticulously, Colonel, most meticulously. The honor of the church is reflected in the appearance of her soldiers.
Your Grace may rely upon my attention to the most minute detail, the colonel assured him. The honor of our service is also reflected by the appearance of our lowliest soldier.
God appreciates your devotion, Colonel.
I live but to serve him, Your Grace, the colonel bowed deeply. Neither man smiled nor winked.
Oh, Dolmant said then, before you leave, Colonel, bring me that ragged little beggar boy. I think I'll leave him with the good brothers of this order, as an act of charity, of course.
Of course, Your Grace. The colonel snapped his fingers, and a burly sergeant dragged Talon by the scruff of the neck to the patriarch. Then Dolmant's battalion advanced on the captain and his men, effectively pinning them against the high wall of the chapter house with their pikes. The sooty soldiers of the Patriarch of Coom were quickly disarmed, and then marched off under close guard. Dolmant affectionately reached down and patted the slender neck of his white mule. Then he looked critically up at the parapet.
"Haven't you left yet, Sparhawk?" he asked.
"We were just making our preparations, Your Grace."
"The day wears on, my son," Dolmant told him. "God's work cannot be accomplished by sloth."
"I'll keep that in mind, Your Grace," Sparhawk said. Then his eyes narrowed, and he stared hard down at Talon.
"Give it back," he commanded.
"What?" Talon answered with a note of anguish in his voice.
"All of it. Every last bit."
"But, Sparhawk..."
"Now, Talon."
Grumbling, the boy began to remove all manner of small, valuable objects from inside his clothes, depositing them in the hands of the startled Patriarch of Deimos. "Are you satisfied now, Sparhawk?" he demanded a bit sullenly, glaring up at the parapet.
"Not entirely, but it's a start. I'll know better after I search you once you're inside the gate."
Talon sighed and dug into several more hidden pockets, adding more items to Dolmant's already overflowing hands.
"I assume you're taking this boy with you, Sparhawk?" Dolmant asked, tucking his valuables inside his cassock.
"Yes, Your Grace," Sparhawk replied.
"Good. I'll sleep better knowing that he's not roaming the streets. Make haste, my son, and Godspeed."
Then the Patriarch turned his mule and rode on back up the street. Chapter 15. At any rate, Sir Tinian continued his obviously embellished account of certain adventures of his youth, the local Lamarck barons grew tired of these brigands and came to our chapter house to enlist our aid in exterminating them. We had all grown rather bored with patrolling the Zamok border, so we agreed. To be honest about the whole thing, we looked upon the affair as something in the nature of a sporting event, a few days of hard riding and a nice brisk fight at the end. Sparhawk let his attention wander. Tinian's compulsive talking had been virtually uninterrupted since they had left Kyrelos and crossed the border into the southern kingdom of Camoria. Although the stories were at first amusing, they eventually grew repetitious. To hear Tinian tell it, he had figured prominently in every major battle and minor skirmish on the Eosian continent in the past 10 years. Sparhawk concluded that the Alcyone knight was not so much an unabashed braggart as he was an ingenious storyteller who put himself in the center of the action of each story to give it a certain immediacy. It was a harmless pastime, really, and it helped to make the miles go faster as they rode down into Camoria on the road to Borata. The sun was warmer here than it had been in Alania, and the breeze that skipped puffball clouds across the intensely blue sky smelled almost spring-like. The fields around them, untouched by frost, were still green, and the road unwound like a white ribbon, dipping into valleys and snaking up verdant hillsides. It was a good day for a ride, and Farron was obviously enjoying himself. Sparhawk had already begun to make an assessment of his companions. Tinian was very nearly as happy-go-lucky as Colton. The sheer bulk of his upper torso, however, and the professional way he handled his weapons indicated that he would be a solid man in a fight should it come to that. Bavier was perhaps a bit more high-strung. The Cyrenic knights were known for their formality and their piety. They were also touchy. Xavier would need to be handled carefully. Sparhawk decided to have a word in private with Colton. His friend's fondness for casual jesting might need to be curbed where Xavier was concerned. The young Cyrenic, though, would obviously also be an asset in the event of trouble. Euleth was an enigma. He had a towering reputation, but Sparhawk had not had many dealings with the Genidian knights of far northern Thalesia. They were reputed to be fearsome warriors, but the fact that they wore chain mail instead of steel plate armor concerned him a bit. He decided to feel out the huge Thalesian on that score. He reined Farron in slightly to allow Euleth to catch up with him. "Nice morning," he said pleasantly. Euleth grunted. Getting him to talk might prove difficult. Then, surprisingly, he actually volunteered something. "In Thalesia, there's still 2 feet of snow on the ground," he said. "That must be miserable." Euleth shrugged. "You get used to it. And snow makes for good hunting. Boars, stags, trolls, that sort of thing." "Do you actually hunt trolls?" "Sometimes. Every so often a troll goes crazy. If he comes down into the valleys where Alines live and starts killing cows, or people, we have to hunt him down." "I've heard that they're fairly large." "Yes, fairly." "Isn't it a bit dangerous to fight one with only chainmail armor?" "It's not too bad, really. They only use clubs. A man might get his ribs broken sometimes, but that's about all."
"Wouldn't full armor be an advantage?"
"Not if you have to cross any rivers. And we have a lot of rivers in Thalesia. A man can peel off a mail shirt even if he's sitting on the bottom of a river. It might be a little hard to hold your breath long enough to get rid of a full suit of armor, though."
"That makes sense."
"We thought so ourselves. We had a preceptor a while back who thought that we should wear full armor like the other orders, for the sake of appearances. We threw one of our brothers dressed in a mail shirt into the harbor at Emsat. He got out of his shirt and came to the surface in about a minute. The preceptor was wearing full armor. When we threw him in, he didn't come back up. Maybe he found something more interesting to do down there."
"You drowned your preceptor?" Sparhawk asked in astonishment.
"No," Euleth corrected. "His armor drowned him. Then we elected Comier as preceptor. He's got better sense than to make foolish suggestions like that."
"You Genidians appear to be an independent sort of order. You actually elect your own preceptors?"
"Don't you?"
"Not really, no. We send a panel of names to the hierarchy and let them do the choosing."
"We make it easier for them. We only send them one name."
Colton came back down the road at a canter. The big blonde man had been riding about a quarter of a mile in the lead to scout out possible danger. "There's something strange up ahead, Sparhawk," he said tensely.
"How do you mean strange?"
"There's a pair of pandions at the top of the next hill." There was a slightly strained note in Colton's voice, and he was visibly sweating.
"Who are they?"
"I didn't go up there to ask." Sparhawk looked sharply at his friend.
"What's the matter?" he asked.
"I'm not sure," Colton replied. "I just had a strong feeling that I shouldn't go near them for some reason. I think they want to talk with you. Don't ask me where I got that idea, either."
"All right," Sparhawk said.
"I'll go see what they want." He spurred Farron into a gallop and thudded up the long slope of the road toward the hilltop. The two mounted men wore black pandion armor, but they gave none of the customary signs of greeting as Sparhawk approached, and neither of them raised his visor. Their horses were peculiarly gaunt, almost skeletal.
"What is it, brothers?" Sparhawk asked, reining Farron in a few yards from the pair.
He caught a momentary whiff of an unpleasant smell, and a chill ran through him. One of the armored figures turned slightly and pointed a steel-clad arm down into the next valley. He did not speak, but appeared to be pointing at a winter-denuded elm grove at one side of the road about a half-mile farther on.
"I don't quite..." Sparhawk started.
Then he caught the sudden glint of sunlight on polished steel among the spidery branches of the grove. He shaded his eyes with one hand and peered intently at the cluster of trees. He saw a hint of movement, and another flash of reflected light.
"I see," he said gravely. "Thank you, my brothers. Would you care to join us in routing the ambushers waiting below?"
For a long moment, neither black-armored figure responded.
Then one of them inclined his head in assent. They both moved then, one to either side of the road, and sat their horses, waiting. Puzzled by their strange behavior, Sparhawk rode back down the road to rejoin the others. "We've got some trouble up ahead," he reported. "There's a group of armed men hiding in a grove of trees in the next valley." "An ambush?" Tinian asked. "People don't usually hide unless they've got some mischief in mind." "Could you tell how many there are?" Xavier asked, loosening his lochaber from its sling on his saddle bow. "Not really." "One way to find out," Euleth said, reaching for his axe. "Who are the two Pandions?" Colton asked nervously. "They didn't say." "Did they give you the same kind of feeling they gave me?" "What kind of feeling?" "As if my blood had just frozen." Sparhawk nodded. "Something like that," he admitted. "Curic," he said then, "you and Beirut take Sophronia, Flute, and Talon to some place out of sight." The squire nodded curtly. "All right then, gentlemen," Sparhawk said to the other knights. "Let's go have a look." They started out at a rolling trot, five armored knights mounted on war horses and wielding a variety of unpleasant-looking weapons. At the top of the hill they were joined by the two silent men in black armor. Once again Sparhawk caught that unpleasant smell, and once again his blood ran strangely cold. "Has anybody got a horn?" Tinian asked. "We should let them know we're coming." Euleth unbuckled one of his saddlebags and took out the curled and twisted horn of some animal. It was quite large and had a brass mouthpiece at its tip. "What kind of an animal has horns like that?" Colton asked him. "Ogre," Euleth replied. Then he set the mouthpiece to his lips and blew a shattering blast. "For the glory of God and the honor of the church," Xavier exclaimed, rising in his stirrups and flourishing his lochaber. Sparhawk drew his sword and drove his spurs into Farron's flanks. The big horse plunged eagerly ahead, his ears laid back and his teeth bared. There were shouts of chagrin from the elm grove as the church knights plunged down the hill at a gallop, with the grass whipping at the legs of their chargers. Then perhaps 18 armored men on horseback broke out of their concealment and rode out into the open to meet the charge. "They want a fight!" Tinian shouted jubilantly. "Watch yourselves when we mix with them," Sparhawk warned. "There may be more hiding in the grove." Euleth continued to sound his horn until the last moment. Then he quickly stuffed it back into his saddlebag and began to whirl his great war axe about his head. Three of the ambushers had held back. Just before the two parties crashed together, they turned tail and rode off at a dead run, flogging their horses in sheer panic. The initial impact might easily have been heard a mile away. Sparhawk and Farron were slightly in the lead, with the others fanned out and back in a kind of wedge formation. Sparhawk stood up in his stirrups to deliver broad overhand strokes to the right and the left as he crashed into the strangers. He split open a helmet and saw blood and brains come gushing out as the man fell stiffly out of his saddle. On his next stroke, his sword sheared through an upraised shield, and he heard a scream as his blade bit into the arm to which the shield was strapped. Behind him he could hear the sounds of other blows and shrieks as his friends followed him through the melee. Their rush through the center of the ambushers left 10 down, killed or maimed, but as they whirled to attack again, a half-dozen more came crashing out of the grove to attack them from the rear. "Go ahead," Xavier shouted as he wheeled his horse. "I'll hold these off while you finish the rest." He raised his lochaber and charged. "Help him, Colton," Sparhawk called to his friend, then led Tinian, Euleth, and the two strangers against the dazed survivors of their first attack. Tinian's broadsword had a much wider blade than those of the Pandions, and thus a great deal more weight. That weight made the weapon savagely efficient, and Tinian cut through flesh or armor with equal ease. Euleth's axe, of course, had no finesse or subtlety. He hewed at men as a woodsman might hew at trees. Sparhawk briefly saw one of the two strange Pandions rise in his stirrups to deliver a vast overhand blow. What the knight held in its gauntleted fist, however, was not a sword, but rather that same kind of glowing nimbus that had been given to Sophronia in the shabby upstairs apartment in Kyrillos by the insubstantial ghost of Sir Lacus. The nimbus appeared to pass completely through the body of the awkward mercenary the Pandion faced. The man's face went absolutely white, and he stared down at his chest in horror, but there was no blood, and his rust-splotched armor remained intact. With a shriek of terror, he threw his sword away and fled. Then Sparhawk's attention was diverted by another enemy.
When the last of the ambushers had fallen, Sparhawk wheeled Farron to go to the aid of Bavier and Colton, but saw that it was largely unnecessary. Three of the men who had come charging out of the elm grove were already down. Another was doubled over in his saddle with both hands pressed to his belly. The other two were trying desperately to parry the blows of Colton's sword and Bavier's Lochaber axe. Colton feinted with his sword, then smoothly slapped his opponent's weapon out of his hand, even as Bavier lopped the head off his man with an almost casual backhand swipe. "Don't kill him," Sparhawk shouted to Colton as the blonde man raised his sword. "But," Colton protested, "I want to question him." Colton's face grew bleak with disappointment as Sparhawk rode back across the littered turf toward him and Bavier. Sparhawk reined Farron in. "Get off your horse," he told the frightened and exhausted captive. The man slid down. Like that worn by his fallen companions, his armor was a mishmash of unmatched pieces. It was rusty and dented in places, but the sword Colton had knocked from his hand was polished and sharp. "You're a mercenary, I take it," Sparhawk said to him.
"Yes, my lord," the fellow faltered in a Pelosian accent.
"This didn't turn out too well, did it?" Sparhawk asked in an almost comradely fashion. The fellow laughed nervously, looking at the carnage around him.
"No, my lord, not at all the way we expected."
"You did your best," Sparhawk said to him. "Now we'll need the name of the man who hired you."
"I didn't ask his name, my lord."
"Describe him, then."
I cannot, my lord."
"This interview is going to get a lot less pleasant, I think," Colton said.
"Stand him in a fire," Uluth suggested.
"I've always liked pouring boiling pitch inside their armor."
"Slowly,"
Tinian said.
"Thumbscrews," Bavier said firmly.
"You see how it is, neighbor," Sparhawk said to the now ashen-faced prisoner. "You are going to talk. We're here, and the man who hired you isn't. He might have threatened you with unpleasant things, but we're going to do them to you. Save yourself a great deal of discomfort and answer my questions."
"My lord," the man blubbered, "I can't, even if you torture me to death."
Uluth slid down from his saddle and approached the cringing captive.
"Oh, stop that," the Genidian said.
He raised a hand, palm outstretched, over the prisoner's head and spoke in a harsh, grating language Sparhawk did not understand but uneasily suspected was not a human tongue. The captured mercenary's eyes went blank, and he fell to his knees. Falteringly, and with absolutely no expression in his voice, he began to speak in the same language as Uluth had.
"He's been bound in a spell," the Genidian knight reported. "Nothing we could have done to him would have made him talk."
The mercenary went on in that dreadful language, speaking more rapidly now.
"There were two who hired him," Uluth translated. "A hooded styrick and a man with white hair."
"Martell!" Colton exclaimed.
"Very likely," Sparhawk agreed.
The prisoner spoke again.
"It was the styrick who put the spell on him," Uluth said. "It's one I'm not familiar with."
"I don't think I am either," Sparhawk admitted. "We'll see if Sophranian knows it."
"Oh," Uluth added, "that's one other thing. This attack was directed at her."
"What?"
"The orders these men had were to kill the styrick woman."
"Colton!" Sparhawk barked, but the blonde man was already spurring his horse.
"What about him?"
Tinian pointed at the prisoner.
"Let him go!" Sparhawk shouted as he galloped off after Colton.
"Come on!" As they rode over the hilltop, Sparhawk looked back. The two strange Pandions were nowhere in sight. Then, up ahead, he saw them. A group of men had surrounded the rocky knoll where Keurig had hidden Sophrania and the others. The two black-armored knights were sitting their horses coolly between the attackers and the knoll. They were making no effort to fight, but merely stood their ground. As Sparhawk watched, one of the attackers launched a javelin which appeared to pass directly through the body of one of the black-armored Pandions with no visible effect.
"Farron!" Sparhawk barked. "Run!"
It was something he seldom did. He called upon Farron's loyalty instead of his training. The big horse shuddered slightly, then stretched himself out in a run that quickly outdistanced the others. The attackers numbered perhaps 10 men. They were recoiling visibly from the 2 shadowy Pandions blocking their path.
Then one of them looked around and saw Sparhawk descending upon them with the others rushing along behind him, and he shouted a warning. After a moment of stunned paralysis, the shabby attackers bolted, fleeing across the meadow, fleeing in a kind of panic Sparhawk had seldom seen in professionals. He charged up the side of the outcrop with Farron's steel-shod hooves striking sparks from the stones. Just below the crest he reined in. "Is everybody all right?" he called to Keurig. "We're fine," Keurig replied, looking over the hasty breastwork of stone he and Beirut had erected. "It was touch and go until those two knights got here, though." Keurig's eyes looked a bit wild as he stared at the pair who had warded off the assailants. Sophrania came up to the breastwork beside him, and her face was deathly pale. Sparhawk turned to the two strange pandions. "I think it's time for introductions, brothers," he said, "and some explanations." The two made no reply. He looked at them a bit more closely. The horses upon which they sat now appeared even more skeletal, and Sparhawk shuddered as he saw that the animals had no eyes but only vacant eye sockets, and that their bones protruded through their tattered coats. Then the two knights removed their helmets. Their faces seemed somehow filmy and indistinct, almost transparent, and they too were eyeless. One of them appeared very young, and he had butter-colored hair. The other was old, and his hair was white. Sparhawk recoiled slightly. He knew both of them. He knew that they both were dead.
"Sir Sparhawk," the ghost of Parasim said, his voice hollow and emotionless, "pursue thy quest with diligence. Time will not stay for thee."
"Why have you returned from the house of the dead?" Sophrania asked the two in a profoundly formal tone. Her voice was trembling.
"Our oath hath the power to bring us out of the shadows if need be, little mother," the form of Lacus replied, his voice also hollow and void of all emotion. "Others will also fall, and our company will increase ere the queen returns to health." The hollow-eyed shade turned then to Sparhawk. "Guard well our beloved mother, Sparhawk, for she is in grave peril. Should she fall, our deaths are without purpose, and the queen will die."
"I will, Lacus," Sparhawk promised.
"Know also one last thing. In Alana's death, thou shalt lose more than a queen. The darkness hovers at the gate, and Alana is our only hope of light."
Then the two of them shimmered and vanished. The four other knights came charging up the rocky slope and reined in. Colton's face was pallid, and he was visibly trembling. "Who were they?" he asked.
"Parasim and Lacus," Sparhawk replied quietly.
"Parasim? He's dead."
"So's Lacus."
"Ghosts?"
"So it would seem."
Tinian dismounted and pulled off his massive helmet. He was also pale and sweating.
"I've dabbled at times in necromancy," he said, "though not usually by choice. Usually a spirit has to be summoned, but sometimes they'll appear on their own, particularly if they left something important unfinished."
"This was important," Sparhawk said bleakly.
"Was there something else you wanted to tell us, Sparhawk?" Uloth asked then. "You seem to have left a few things out."
Sparhawk looked at Sophrania. Her face was still deathly pale, but she straightened and nodded to him. Sparhawk took a deep breath. "Elana would be dead, but is being preserved by a spell that keeps her sealed within a crystal. The spell was the result of the combined efforts of Sophrania and 12 pandions," he explained.
"I'd been sort of wondering about that," Tinian said.
"There's only one problem with it," Sparhawk continued. "The knights will die one by one until only Sophrania is left."
"And then?" Bavier asked, his voice shaking.
"Then I will also depart," Sophrania replied simply.
A stifled sob escaped the young Cyrenic. "Not while I have breath," he said in a choked voice.
"Someone, however, is trying to speed things up," Sparhawk went on. "This is the third attempt on Sophrania's life since we left Cimera."
"But I have survived them,"
she said as if they were of no moment. Were you able in any way to identify the people behind this attack?
Martell and some Styrek, Colton told her. The Styrek had put a spell on the mercenaries to keep them from talking, but Euleth broke it somehow. He spoke with a prisoner in a language I didn't understand. The man answered in the same tongue. She looked inquiringly at the Thalesian knight.
We spoke in the language of the trolls, Euleth shrugged. It's a non-human tongue, so it circumvented the spell.
She stared at him in horror.
You called upon the troll gods? She gasped.
Sometimes it's necessary, lady, he replied. It's not too dangerous if you're careful.
Xavier's face was tear-streaked. And it please you, my lord Sparhawk, he said. I shall personally undertake the protection of the Lady Sophrenia. I shall remain constantly at this valiant lady's side, and should there be further encounters, I pledge you my life that she shall not be harmed.
A brief expression of consternation crossed Sophrenia's face, and she looked appealingly at Sparhawk.
Probably not a bad idea, he said, ignoring her unspoken objection. All right, then, Xavier, stay with her. Sophrenia gave him a withering look.
Are we going to get the dead under the ground? Tinian asked.
Sparhawk shook his head.
We don't have time to be gravediggers. My brothers are dying one by one, and Sophrenia's at the end of the list. If we see some peasants, we'll tell them where the bodies are. The loot they'll get will more than pay for the digging. Let's move along.
Barata was a university town that had grown up around the stately buildings of the oldest center of higher learning in Eosia. On occasion in the past, the church had strongly urged that the institution be moved to Kyrillos, but the faculty had always resisted that notion, obviously desiring to maintain their independence and the absence of church supervision. Sparhawk and his companions took rooms in one of the local inns late in the afternoon on the day they arrived. The inn was more comfortable and certainly cleaner than the roadside ones in which they had stayed in Alania and here in Camoria. The following morning, Sparhawk put on his mail coat and his heavy wool cloak.
"Do you want us to go with you?" Colton asked as his friend came down into the common room on the main floor of the inn.
"No," Sparhawk replied. "Let's not turn it into a parade. The university isn't very far from here, and I can protect Sophrenia along the way."
Sir Xavier looked as if he were about to protest. He had taken his self-appointed role as Sophrenia's protector very seriously, seldom moving more than a few feet from her side during the journey to Barata. Sparhawk looked at the earnest young Cyrenic.
"I know you've been keeping watch outside her door every night, Xavier," he said. "Why don't you get some sleep? You won't be much good to her or the rest of us if you fall out of your saddle."
Xavier's face stiffened.
"He didn't mean it personally, Xavier," Colton said. "Sparhawk just hasn't quite figured out the meaning of the word diplomatic yet. We're all hoping that someday it might come to him."
Xavier smiled faintly, then he laughed.
"I think it might take me some time to adjust to you, Pandions," he said.
"Look upon it as educational," Colton suggested.
"You know that if you and the lady are successful in finding that cure, we're likely to encounter all kinds of trouble on the way back to Cimera," Tinian said to Sparhawk. "We'll probably run into whole armies trying to stop us."
"Madel," Euleth suggested cryptically, "or Serenium."
"I don't quite follow," Tinian admitted.
"Those armies you mentioned will try to block the road to Kyrillos to keep us from getting there, and then on into Alania. If we ride south to either of those seaports, we can hire a ship and sail around to Vardanias on the west coast of Alania. Faster to travel by sea anyway."
"Let's decide that after we find the cure," Sparhawk said.
Sophrenia came down the stairs with flute.
"Are we ready then?" she asked.
Sparhawk nodded. She spoke briefly to flute. The little girl nodded and crossed the room to where Talon sat.
"You've been selected, Talon," Sophrenia told the boy. "Watch over her while I'm gone."
"But,"
he started to object.
"Just do as she says, Talon," Keurig told him wearily.
"I was going to go out and have a look around."
"No," his father said. "As a matter of fact, you weren't."
Talon's expression grew sulky.
"All right," he said as Flute climbed up into his lap. Since the university grounds were so close, Sparhawk decided against taking their horses. and he and Sophronia walked through the narrow streets of Barata. The small woman looked around. "I haven't been here in a long time," she murmured. "I can't imagine what interest a university could hold for you," Sparhawk smiled, "considering your views on reading."
"I wasn't studying, Sparhawk. I was teaching."
"I should have guessed, I suppose. How are you getting on with Bavier?"
"Fine, except that he won't let me do anything for myself, and that he keeps trying to convert me to the Aline faith."
Her tone was slightly tart. "He is just trying to protect you, your soul as well as your person. Are you trying to be funny?" He decided not to answer that. The grounds of the University of Barata were park-like, and students and members of the faculty strolled contemplatively across the well-kept lawns. Sparhawk stopped a young man in a lime-green doublet.
"Excuse me, neighbor," he said, "but could you direct me to the medical college?"
"Are you ill?"
"No. A friend of mine is, though."
"Ah, the physicians occupy that building over there."
The student pointed at a squat-looking structure made of gray stone.
"Thank you, neighbor. I hope your friend gets better soon."
"So do we."
When they entered the building, they encountered a rotund man in a black robe.
"Excuse me, sir," Sophronia said to him. "Are you a physician?"
"I am."
"Splendid. Have you a few moments?"
The rotund man had been looking closely at Sparhawk.
"Sorry," he said curtly. "I'm busy."
"Could you direct us to one of your colleagues, then?"
"Try any door," he said, waving his hand and walking quickly away from them.
"That's an odd attitude for a healer," Sparhawk said.
"Every profession attracts its share of louts," she replied.
They crossed the antechamber, and Sparhawk rapped on a dark-painted door.
"What is it?"
a weary voice said. "We need to consult a physician." There was a long pause.
"Oh, all right," the weary voice replied. "Come in."
Sparhawk opened the door and held it for Sophronia. The man seated behind the cluttered desk in the cubicle had deep circles beneath his eyes, and it appeared that he had foregone shaving some weeks ago.
"What is the nature of your illness?"
he asked Sophronia in a voice hovering on exhaustion.
"I'm not the one who's ill," she replied.
"Him, then?"
the doctor pointed at Sparhawk.
"He looks robust enough to me."
"No," she said. "He's not ill either. We're here on behalf of a friend."
"I don't go to people's houses."
"We weren't asking you to do that," Sparhawk said.
"Our friend lives some distance away," Sophronia said. "We thought that if we described her symptoms to you, you might be able to hazard a guess as to the cause of her malady."
"I don't make guesses," he told her shortly.
"What are the symptoms?"
"Much like those of the falling sickness," Sophronia told him.
"That's it, then. You've already made the diagnosis yourself."
"There are certain differences, however."
"All right, describe the differences."
"There's a fever involved, quite a high one, and profuse sweating."
"The two don't match, little lady. With a fever, the skin is dry."
"Yes, I know."
"Have you a medical background?"
"I'm familiar with certain folk remedies."
He snorted. "My experience tells me that folk remedies kill more than they cure. What other symptoms did you notice?"
Sophronia meticulously described the illness that had rendered Alana comatose. The physician, however, seemed not to be listening, but was staring instead at Sparhawk. His face became suddenly alert, his eyes narrowed and his expression sly.
"I'm sorry," he said when Sophronia had finished. "I think you'd better go back and take another look at your friend. What you just described matches no known illness."
His tone was abrupt, even curt. Sparhawk straightened, clenching his fist, but Sophronia laid her hand on his arm.
"Thank you for your time, learned sir," she said smoothly.
"Come along, then," she told Sparhawk.
The two of them went back out into the corridor.
"Two in a row," Sparhawk muttered.
"Two what?"
"People with bad manners.
It stands to reason, perhaps."
"I don't follow you."
"There's a certain natural arrogance in those who teach." You've never displayed it.
I keep it under control.
Try another door, Sparhawk. In the next 2 hours, they spoke with 7 physicians. Each of them, after a searching look at Sparhawk's face, pretended ignorance. I'm starting to get a peculiar feeling about this, he growled as they emerged from yet another office. They take one look at me and they suddenly become stupid. Or is that just my imagination?
I've noticed that too, she replied thoughtfully.
My face isn't that exciting, I know, but it's never struck anyone dumb before.
It's a perfectly good face, Sparhawk.
It covers the front of my head. What else can you expect from a face?
The physicians of Barata seem less skilled than we'd been led to believe.
We've wasted more time, then?
We haven't finished yet. Don't give up hope.
They came finally to a small, unpainted door set back in a shabby alcove. Sparhawk rapped, and a slurred voice responded.
Go away!
We need your help, learned sir, Sophronia said.
Go bother somebody else. I'm busy getting drunk right now.
That does it, Sparhawk snapped. He grasped the door handle and pushed, but the door was locked from the inside. Irritably, he kicked it open, splintering the frame. The man inside the tiny cubicle blinked. He was a shabby little man with a crooked back and bleary eyes.
You knock very loudly, friend, he observed.
Then he belched.
Well, don't just stand there. Come in.
His head weaved back and forth. He was shabbily dressed, and his wispy gray hair stuck out in all directions.
Is there something in the water around here that makes everybody so churlish? Sparhawk asked acidly.
I wouldn't know, the shabby man replied. I never drink water.
He drank noisily from a battered tankard.
Obviously. Shall we spend the rest of the day exchanging insults, or would you rather tell me about your problem?
The physician squinted myopically at Sparhawk's face.
So you're the one, he said.
The one what?
The one we aren't supposed to talk to.
Would you like to explain that?
A man came here a few days ago.
He said that it would be worth 100 gold pieces to every physician in the building if you left empty-handed.
What did he look like?
He had a military bearing and white hair.
Martell, Sparhawk said to Sophronia.
We should have guessed almost immediately, she replied.
Take heart, friends, the messy little man told them expansively. You've found your way to the finest physician in Barata.
He grinned then.
My colleagues all fly south with the ducks in the fall, going quack, quack, quack. You couldn't get a sound medical opinion out of any one of them. The white-haired man said that you described some symptoms. Some lady someplace is very ill, I understand, and your friend, this Martell you mentioned, would prefer that she didn't recover.
Why don't we disappoint him?
He drank deeply from his tankard.
You're a credit to your profession, good doctor, Sophronia said.
No, I'm a vicious-minded old drunkard. Do you really want to know why I'm willing to help you? It's because I'll enjoy the screams of anguish from my colleagues when all that money slips through their fingers.
That's as good a reason as any, I suppose, Sparhawk said.
Exactly.
The slightly tipsy physician peered at Sparhawk's nose.
Why didn't you have that set when it got broken? He asked.
Sparhawk touched his nose. I was busy with other things.
I can fix it for you if you'd like. All I have to do is take a hammer and break it again. Then I can set it for you.
Thanks, all the same, but I'm used to it now.
Suit yourself. All right. What are these symptoms you came here to describe?
Once again, Sophronia ran down the list for him. He sat scratching at his ear with his eyes narrowed. Then he rummaged through the litter piled high on his desk and pulled out a thick book with a torn leather cover. He leafed through it for several moments, then slammed it shut.
Just as I thought, he said triumphantly.
He belched again.
Well?
Sparhawk said.
Your friend was poisoned. Has she died yet?
A chill caught at Sparhawk's stomach.
No, he replied. It's only a matter of time.
The physician shrugged.
It's a rare poison from Rendor. It's invariably fatal.
Sparhawk clenched his teeth.
I'm going to go back to Cimera and disembowel Aeneas, he grated, with a dull knife.
The disreputable little physician suddenly looked interested.
You do it this way, he suggested. Make a lateral incision just below the navel. Then kick him over backward. Everything ought to fall out at that point.
Thank you.
No charge. If you're going to do something, do it right. I take it that this Aeneas person is the one you think was responsible?
Undoubtedly.
Go ahead and kill him, then. I despise a poisoner.
Is there an antidote for this poison? Sophronia asked.
None that I know of. I'd suggest talking with several physicians I know in Cypria, but your friend will be dead before you could get back.
No, Sophronia disagreed. She's being sustained.
I'd like to know how you managed that.
The lady is Styric, Sparhawk told him. She has access to certain unusual things.
Magic? Does that really work?
At times, yes.
All right, then, maybe you do have time.
The seedy-looking doctor ripped a corner off one of the papers on his desk and dipped a quill into a nearly dry inkpot.
The first two names here are those of a couple of fairly adept physicians in Cypria, he said as he scrawled on the paper. This last one is the name of the poison.
He handed the paper to Sparhawk.
Good luck, he said. Now get out of here so I can continue what I was doing before you kicked in my door.
Chapter 16
Because you don't look like Rendors, Sparhawk told them. Foreigners attract a great deal of attention there, usually unfriendly. I can pass for a native in Cypria, so can Curic. Renderish women wear veils, so Sophrania's appearance won't be a problem. The rest of you are going to have to stay behind.
They were gathered in a large room on the upper floor of the inn near the university. The room was bare, with only a few benches along the walls and no curtains at the narrow window. Sparhawk had reported what the tipsy physician had said, and the fact that Martell had attempted subterfuge this time rather than a physical confrontation.
We could put something on our hair to change the color, Calton protested. Wouldn't that get us by?
It's the manner, Calton, Sparhawk explained. I could dye you green and people would still know that you're an Alanian. The same's more or less true of the rest of you. You all have the bearing of knights. It takes years to erase that.
You want us to stay here, then? Euleth asked.
No. Let's all go down to Madel, Sparhawk decided. If something unexpected comes up in Cypria, I can get word to you there faster.
I think you're overlooking something, Sparhawk, Calton said.
We know that Martell's moving around down here, and he's probably got eyes everywhere. If we all ride out of Barata in full armor, he'll know about it before we cover half a league.
Pilgrims, Euleth grunted cryptically.
I don't quite follow you, Calton said, frowning.
If we pack our armor in a cart and dress in sober clothes, we can join a group of pilgrims, and nobody's going to give us a second glance.
He looked at Bavier.
Do you know very much about Madel? He asked.
We have a chapter house there, Bavier replied. I visit it from time to time.
Are there any shrines or holy places there?
Several, but pilgrims seldom travel in winter.
They do if they get paid. We'll hire some, and a clergyman to sing hymns as we go along.
It's got possibilities, Sparhawk, Calton said. Martell doesn't really know which way we're going when we leave here, so his spies are going to be spread fairly thin.
How will we know this Martell person, Xavier asked, should we encounter him while you're in Cypria, I mean?
Calton knows him, Sparhawk replied, and Talon has seen him once. Then he remembered something. He looked over at the boy who was making a cat's cradle to entertain flute.
Talon, he said, could you draw pictures of Martell and Kroger?
Of course.
And we can conjure up the image of Ardus as well, Sophronia added.
Ardus is easy, Calton said. Just put armor on a gorilla and you've got him.
All right, we'll do it that way then, Sparhawk said.
Beirut?
Yes, Lord Sparhawk.
Go find a church somewhere, a poor one. Talk with the vicar. Tell him that we'll finance a pilgrimage to the shrines in Mardell. Ask him to pick a dozen or so of his neediest parishioners and to bring them here tomorrow morning. We'll want him to come with us as well, to be the caretaker of our souls. And tell him that we'll make a sizable contribution to his church if he agrees.
Won't he ask about our motives, my lord?
Tell him that we've committed a dreadful sin and want to atone for it, Calton shrugged. Just don't be too specific about the sin.
Sir Calton, Xavier gasped. You would lie to a churchman?
It's not exactly a lie, Xavier. We've all committed sins. I've sinned at least a half dozen times this week already. Besides, the vicar of a poor church isn't going to ask too many questions when there's a contribution involved. Sparhawk took a leather pouch from inside his tunic. He shook it a few times, and a distinctive jingling sound came from it. All right, gentlemen, he said, untying the top of the pouch. We've reached the part of this service you all enjoy the most, the offertory. God appreciates a generous giver, so don't be shy. The vicar will need cash to hire pilgrims. He passed the pouch around. Do you think God might accept a promissory note? Calton asked. God might. I won't. Put something in the pouch, Calton. The group that gathered in the innyard the following morning was uniformly shabby. Widows in patched mourning, out-of-work artisans, and several hungry beggars. They were all mounted on weary nags or sleepy-looking mules. Sparhawk looked at them from the window. Tell the innkeeper to feed them, he said to Calton. There's quite a number of them, Sparhawk. I don't want them fainting from hunger a mile out of town. You take care of that while I go talk with the vicar. Anything you say, Calton shrugged. Should I bathe them, too? Some of them look a bit unwashed. That won't be necessary. Feed their horses and mules as well.
Aren't we being a little overgenerous?
You get to carry any horse that collapses.
Oh.
I'll see to it right away, then.
The vicar of the poor church was a thin, anxious-looking man in his 60s. His silvery hair was curly, and his face was drawn and deeply lined with care.
My lord, he said, bowing deeply to Sparhawk. Please, good vicar, Sparhawk said to him. Just pilgrim is adequate. We are all equal in the service of God. My companions and I wish simply to join with your good pious folk and to journey to Mardell that we may worship at the holy shrines there for the solace of our souls and in the certain knowledge of the infinite mercy of God.
Well said, pilgrim.
Would you join us at table, good vicar? Sparhawk asked him. We will go many miles before we sleep tonight.
The vicar's eyes grew suddenly bright.
I would be delighted, my lord, pilgrim, that is.
The feeding of the Camorian pilgrims and their mounts took quite some time and stretched the capacity of the kitchen and the stable grain bins to a considerable degree.
I've never seen people eat so much, Calton grumbled. Clad in a sturdy, unmarked cloak, he swung up into his saddle just outside the inn.
They were hungry, Sparhawk told him. At least we can see to it that they get a few good meals before they have to return to Baratta.
Charity, Sir Sparhawk? Xavier asked. Isn't that a bit out of character? The grim-faced Pandions are not noted for their tender sensibilities.
How little you know them, Sir Xavier, Sophronia murmured. She mounted her white palfrey, then held down her hands to flute. But the little girl shook her head, walked over to Farron, and reached out her tiny hand. The big roan lowered his head, and she caressed his velvety nose. Sparhawk felt an odd quiver run through his mount's body. Then Flute insistently raised her hands to the big Pandion. Gravely, Sparhawk leaned over and lifted her into her accustomed place in front of the saddle, and enfolded her in his cloak. She nestled against him, took out her pipes, and began to play that same minor melody she had been playing when they had first found her. The vicar at the head of their column intoned a brief prayer, invoking the protection of the god of the Alenes during their journey, an invocation punctuated by questioning, even skeptical, trills from Flute's pipes.
"Behave yourself," Sparhawk whispered to her. "He's a good man, and he's doing what he thinks is right."
She rolled her eyes roguishly. Then she yawned,
snuggled closer to him, and promptly went to sleep. They rode south out of Barata under a clear morning sky, with Keurig and the two-wheeled cart containing their armor and equipment clattering along behind them. The breeze was gusty, and it tugged at the ragged clothing of the pilgrims patiently plodding along behind their vicar. A line of low mountains lay to the west, touched with snow on their peaks, and the sunlight glistened on those white fields. Their pace as they rode seemed to Sparhawk leisurely, even lackadaisical, though the panting and wheezing of the poor mounts of the pilgrims was a fair indication that the beasts were being pressed as hard as was possible. It was about noon when Calton rode forward from his station at the rear of the column. "There are riders coming up behind us," he reported quietly to avoid alarming nearby pilgrims. "They're pushing hard." "Any idea of who they are?" "They're wearing red." "Church soldiers, then." "Notice how quick he is," Calton observed to the others. "How many?" Tinian asked. "It looks to be a reinforced platoon." Xavier loosened his Lochaber axe in its sling. "Keep that under cover," Sparhawk told him. "The rest of you hide your weapons as well." Then he raised his voice. "Good vicar," he called ahead. "How about a hymn? The miles go easier with sacred music for company." The vicar cleared his throat and began to sing in a rusty, off-key voice. Wearily, but responding automatically to their pastor's lead, the other pilgrims joined in. "Sing," Sparhawk commanded his companions, and they all raised their voices in the familiar hymn. As they bawled their song, Flute lifted her pipes and played a mocking little counterpoint. "Stop that," Sparhawk murmured to her, "and if there's trouble, slide down and run out into that field." She rolled her eyes at him. "Do as you're told, young lady. I don't want you getting trampled if there's a fight." The church soldiers, however, pounded past the column of hymn-singing pilgrims with hardly a glance, and were soon lost in the distance ahead. "Tense," Euleth commented. "Truly," Tinian agreed. "Trying to fight in the middle of a crowd of terrified pilgrims might have been interesting." "Do you think they were searching for us?" Beirut asked. "It's hard to say," Sparhawk replied. "I wasn't going to stop them to ask, though." They moved southward toward Madel in easy stages to conserve the sorry mounts of the vicar's parishioners, and they arrived on the outskirts of the port city about noon on the fourth day out of Barata. When the town came into view, Sparhawk rode forward to join the vicar at the head of the column. He handed the good man a pouch full of coins. "We'll be leaving you here," he said. "A matter has come up that needs our attention." The vicar gave him a speculative look. "This was all subterfuge, wasn't it, my lord?" he asked gravely. "I may be only the poor pastor of a poverty-stricken chapel, but I recognize the manner and bearing of church knights when I see them." "Forgive us, good vicar," Sparhawk replied. "Take your people to the holy places here in Madel. Lead them in prayer, and then see to it that they're well fed. Then return to Barata, and use whatever money is left as you see fit." "And may I do this with a clear conscience, my son?" "The clearest, good pastor. My friends and I serve the church in a matter of gravest urgency, and your aid will be appreciated by the members of the hierocracy in Kyrelos, most of them at any rate." Then Sparhawk turned Farron around and rode back to his companions. "All right, Bavier," he said. "Take us to your chapter house." "I have been considering that, Sir Sparhawk," Xavier replied. "Our chapter house here is closely watched by local authorities and all manner of other folk. Even garbed as we are, we would surely be recognized." Sparhawk grunted. "You're probably right. Can you think of any alternatives?" "Perhaps so. As it happens, I have a kinsman, a marquis from Eastern Arsham, who has a villa on the outskirts of the city. I have not seen him for some years. Our family disapproves of him because he's in trade, but perhaps he will remember me. He's a good-natured fellow, and if I approach him right, he might extend his hospitality." "It's worth a try, I guess." "All right, lead the way." They rode around the western outskirts of Madel to an opulent house surrounded by a low wall built of the local sandstone. The house was set back some distance from the road and was surrounded by tall evergreens and well-groomed lawns. There was a graveled court directly in front of the house, and they dismounted there. A servant in sober livery emerged from the house and approached inquiringly.
Would you be so good as to advise the Marquis that his second cousin, Sir Bavier, and several friends would like to have a word with him? The Sirenic inquired politely. At once, my lord. The servant returned and re-entered the house. The man who emerged from the house a few moments later was stout and had a florid face. He wore one of the colorful silk robes common in southern Camoria, rather than Arshan doublet and hose, and his welcoming grin was broad.
Bavier, he greeted his distant cousin with a warm handclasp. What are you doing in Camoria?
Seeking refuge, Lysian, Bavier replied, his open young face clouded momentarily. The family has not treated you well, Lysian, he admitted. I could not blame you if you turned me and my friends away.
Nonsense, Bavier. The decision to take up trading was mine. I knew how the rest of the family would feel about it. I'm delighted to see you.
You mentioned refuge. Bavier nodded.
We're here on church business of some delicacy, he said, and there are a few too many eyes watching the Cyrenic chapter house in the city. I know it's a great deal to ask, but might we impose on your hospitality?
By all means, my boy, by all means. Marquis Lysian clapped his hands sharply, and several grooms came out of the stables.
See to the mounts of these visitors and their cart, the Marquis ordered.
Then he laid his hand on Bavier's shoulder.
Come in, he invited them all. My house is yours.
He turned and led the way through the low arched doorway and on into the house. Once they were inside, they followed him to a pleasant room with low cushioned furniture and a fireplace where several logs crackled and snapped.
Please, friends, sit, Lysian said.
Then he looked speculatively at them.
This church business of yours must be very important, Bavier, he guessed.
Gathering from their features, I'd say that your friends represent all four of the militant orders.
Your eyes are sharp, Marquis, Sparhawk told him.
Am I going to get in trouble over this? Lysian asked. Then he grinned. Not that I care, mind you, it's just that I like to be prepared.
It's not too likely, Sparhawk assured him, particularly if we're successful in our mission.
Tell me, my lord, do you have contacts in the harbor?
Extensive ones, sir.
Sparhawk, the Pandion supplied.
Champion of the Queen of Elania?
Lysian looked surprised.
I heard that you'd returned from your exile in Rendor, but aren't you a bit far afield? Shouldn't you be in Cimera trying to circumvent the attempts of the Primate Aeneas to depose your lady?
You're well informed, my lord, Sparhawk said.
I have widespread commercial contacts.
Lysian shrugged. He winked at Bavier.
That's what disgraced me in the eyes of the family. My agents and the masters of my ships gather much information in the course of their dealings.
I gather, my lord, that you're not overly fond of the Primate of Cimera.
The man's a scoundrel.
Our sentiments exactly, Carlton agreed.
Very well, then, my lord, Sparhawk said.
What we're involved with is an attempt to counter the growing power of the Primate. If we're successful, we can stop him in his tracks. I'd tell you more, but it might be dangerous for you if you knew too many of the details.
I can appreciate that, Sir Sparhawk, Lysian said. Tell me, in what way can I help?
Three of us need to go to Cypria, Sparhawk replied. For the sake of your own safety, it might be better if we were to take the ship of an independent sea captain rather than one of your own vessels. If you could direct us to such a captain, and perhaps give us a discreetly worded letter of introduction to him, we can take care of the rest.
Sparhawk, Kurek said sharply, looking around the room. What happened to Talon?
Sparhawk turned quickly.
I thought he was bringing up the rear when we came in.
So did I.
Bayret, Sparhawk said, go find him.
At once, my lord. The novice hurried from the room. End of side 6. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.